and it's 6 past the hour on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosophers, kings and queens, working class heroes. Yeah, good morning, cat people. How are you? Does that remind you of anything? Did that wake you up in the middle of the night? Did it? Good morning, guilt-ridden people, bullies. How are you? Nice to talk to you. Mark Riley, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. You know, I'm starting to get an inferiority complex getting lined up behind all of these people, the geniuses and the philosopher kings and the bullies and the snot noses and all
why,
that.
Why don't you just look at it as your lead-in? Why do you got to look at it as an inferiority complex?
I look at it from all aspects.
We're building to you, Mark Riley.
Oh, okay.
We're setting you up, man.
Thank you very much. How you doing?
I'm pretty good.
You all right?
I couldn't help but watch it, the verdicts being read. I couldn't help it. I'm watching CNN.
I had to watch it. Rather cut in on whatever it was I was. I think I was watching Marilyn Milian or somebody.
I was watching
court.
CNN.
Yeah.
And they said, you know, they had a countdown to the verdict.
Yeah.
And, you know, I hadn't heard that much applause since Richard Pryor's first concert movie, man.
I'm telling you, man.
They said, you know, death penalty, and, man, people were like, yeah.
California scream. You know what struck me, though? I listened to the individual poll of the jurors afterwards. Because, you know, when this kind of thing is done, the lawyer asks to make sure that each juror affirms that was what they voted to do. And all of these people were so affirmative, it was like, hey, yo, you're done, pal.
Yeah.
You're finished.
They talked to three of the jurors right afterwards, and I felt kind of bad for them. You know, I mean, I felt bad because it's like they've been through this harrowing thing. They've just made a decision to, you know, terminate some guy's life based on his crime. And they're like, so what was it that really did it? Well, that, you know, what do they think they're going to say? That he was a psychopath with no conscience and he killed his wife and unborn child? What else do you need exactly? Can we move on here?
But you know what? I blame the jurors for part of that, because most juries, once they're done, can say, look, I'm not doing any interviews. There are many, many juries over time that have just said, no, we're not talking to any reporters under any circumstances. Unfortunately, what has driven a lot of jurors in, I'm not saying in this case, but what has driven a lot of jurors in the past is the lure of money.
Yeah.
Because they figure, you know, hey, juror number 12, my story. You know what I'm saying?
I was talking to Larson before the show, Clutch Larson, and I said, you know, it's one of the big nightmares I have about jury duty, you know, which I've managed to avoid because I keep moving around, not on purpose, you know, more than willing to do it, but just that you get, you know, strung into
one step behind those
6 months, 2 years, you know, trial. And literally, I imagine it would be an interesting character study to see, you know, to talk to jurors whose lives have been literally ruined by jury duty.
Yeah.
Like, they're sequestered, they can't, you know, see their family, they can't do anything, they're in hotel rooms for months on end. It's almost like being away, you know, in the forces or something, and they come back and, you know, they probably have a hard time getting their job back, they probably have a hard time reintegrating into society. They've got the, you know, on their conscience, they've got this horrendous thing that they've had to, think about for months on end and make decisions about someone else's life. Where do you stand on it? Do you think he should die? Are you at a death penalty?
I am unalterably opposed to the death penalty. However, I got to say, when it comes to juries, these guys may have it bad, but the ones that have it the worst, the absolute worst, are jurors in mob trials.
Right.
Because in mob trials, you don't always have to worry about being sequestered and all that. You have to worry about the possibility somebody's going to tamper with you, and you have to worry about the possibility someone's going to find out who you are and where you live and send somebody to see your family.
You don't got
to
tell me. I saw the movie Runaway Jury. Are you kidding me? Boy, the stuff that goes into that, they set up. Did you see that ridiculous movie?
No, I've never seen it.
About the guy who's putting together a jury for, for the tobacco company lawsuit, or not tobacco, firearms.
Okay.
Right? And like the guy, Gene Hackman, plays the jury, the coordinator. What do you call that guy, Kalo?
Selector?
He was a jury selector, but, you know, within seconds, they set up this high-tech outfit where they've got surveillance on every possible juror, and they're out in their lives, and they're sending people out to tamper with them, and they're, you know, they've got airplanes, you know, circling.
So awkward.
It was ridiculous. Those kind of movies just baffle me. It's like that movie Outbreak with Dustin Hoffman. He was in two of these movies where they're completely ridiculous, and they push it way out to the margins as to what you know, way beyond anything you can possibly believe, and then somehow or another, just ends a human story.
Well, they try and push it toward fantasy and then bring it back.
At the end of Outbreak, they find the one monkey. they're about to, like, end the world. They're about to nuke a town in this country, you know, in order to stop a viral outbreak, but instead, Dustin Hoffman, they find the one monkey that got away from the box that started the whole thing, and they kill that monkey.
Well, you know, that's relatively optimistic compared to, for example, the original Dawn of the Dead, where, you know, they never did find out what was turning people into zombies. All they did was shoot Dwayne Jones at the end of the flick.
Yeah, well, thank God we know it's the Republican Party that turns people into zombies. You're talking about Night of the Living Dead?
I'm sorry, Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah,
that guy was my English professor, you know. Dwayne Jones,
before he was killed in the movie?
The brother, before he got killed, actually, after he got, he's dead now, actually, but he was an English, he was one of the founders of the Black Filmmakers Foundation.
Yeah.
And a really, a very good guy, and that was kind of like his breakthrough film, Dawn of the Dead.
And did he do more?
Yeah, he did some stuff, but he taught. I mean, he taught English. That was his shtick. And, you know, he was also an actor. He was just but remember that during this particular...
So he spent a lifetime fighting zombies.
He spent a lifetime fighting zombies, and he also spent a lifetime trying to get work. Because black actors, and even up through the blaxploitation era, you know, if you weren't willing to do that kind of work, you didn't work that often.
Right. So, but it's just funny that it must be just as hard to fight zombies as it is to teach, high school English?
No, this is college. This is my first year at NYU.
That's a little better.
A little better, yeah.
I couldn't imagine. Can you imagine being a high school teacher? It must be so difficult. When we went and talked to that high school, those were pretty attentive kids. But about 10 minutes in, I saw a couple of them drifting, like
at least they weren't necking with their girlfriends.
I would rather that. At least it'd be exciting for both of us.
I had one teacher that knew how to maintain the classroom decorum. This was when I was in military school.
Yeah,
I had a teacher named Mr. Cowan.
Mm-hmm.
All right, at the beginning, the first class we had, guys in there all rambunctious and stuff. The guy says, "Listen, I want to show you something."
Mm-hmm.
He takes a piece of chalk, puts it between his index finger and his thumb, and crushes it with his finger.
Into dust?
Into dust.
Yeah.
Blows it away.
Yeah.
Never a problem, man.
Really?
Not a single... The guy was not one of these martial arts experts or whatever.
Yeah.
Didn't look that part.
Yeah.
He was an older, portly-looking guy.
Yeah.
But he apparently had served as some kind of a martial arts expert during, I believe, the Korean War.
Yeah, and that's one of whenever a martial arts person is in a conflict, they always carry chalk with them.
This was in a classroom. The chalk was right there.
No, there's all these weird martial art techniques that are seemingly meaningless, but you could just pull them up.
You pull it up like that, he never had a problem. Nobody ever raised their voice in
that
his
wouldn't
classroom.
Work if you were surrounded by, seven guys. Hold on. I got a piece of chalk.
I got a piece of chalk.
I'm going to powder this baby. I watched, what did I watch last night that I got sucked into? But before I get too far off topic, now, Peterson, the judge can say no to the death penalty
if he wants. In California, it's interesting. A judge could not, had they given him life, a judge could not give him death.
Mm-hmm.
But since they gave him death, a judge could give him life in prison.
Yeah.
Well, it also could be 2 or 3 decades. We could all be in walkers by the time they actually get ready to execute this guy.
Right.
You know, he's got appeals up the wazoo. I think people are going to kind of... I wasn't quite sure why this turned out to be such a spectacular worldwide case, but I'm not sure how long it's going to stay in the public consciousness once the Klieg lights go down and the reporters and court TV go someplace else.
Yeah, once they go feed elsewhere.
Oh, yeah, and feed they will elsewhere.
The feeding circle.
Nancy Grace is looking for somebody, right? Some murderer somewhere to spotlight and to make into, a horrible... I mean, look, this guy Peterson, I thought, deserved life without parole. I am a strong proponent of life in prison without the possibility of parole, and that means...
You're a proponent of let him rot naturally.
Yes. Yeah. Let them rot naturally, stew in their own juices, and contemplate the error of their ways.
Okay. There you go. So we're going to come back. We're going to talk about what McCain said about Rumsfeld. We're going to talk about Pinochet seeing his day in court and the possibility of an Iraqi Hitler. 15 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley. You're listening to Morning Sedition. Somehow we got derailed there on the break. I watched part of Tombstone last night.
Uh-huh.
Kent, the Colonel Jones. You seen Tombstone? You have?
Yeah.
Come on in here a minute, because I don't know what happened with that movie. Because it had a great cast. You know what I mean? It should have been a great movie. You know, it had like the amazing cast and some amazing actors. Powers Booth played the bad guy. Kurt Russell played Wyatt Earp. Sam Elliott, Bill Paxton. You saw it, right?
Yeah.
What the hell happened to that movie? About midway through, it just turned to crap. I don't know what happened because it had such a great cast, right?
Yeah, you know, the problems with Westerns, though, you know, that's such a time-worn genre that, my God, it's so hard to do anything.
That's got
to
be like the third remake of Wyatt Earp. Because there was Gunfight at the OK Corral. Well, wasn't there, with Kirk Douglas.
There was the 23-hour-long movie that Kevin Costner made, was bad.
I was born, aged, died, and was born again and aged again by the end of that movie.
But the conversation we just got in, you know, talking about, I guess, off of Scott Peterson. I don't know how we.
Tombstone. Yeah.
I don't know. But the conversation is that like Wyatt Earp, because when Riley was growing up, he said that you grew to sort of mythologize this guy as nothing but a good guy.
Well, yeah, because that, you know, we had the television series Wyatt Earp,
of course,
with Hugh O'Brien, which, you know, I mean, that was the only thing he ever did, as far as I know, in terms of television.
When I was 7 years old,
yeah,
the first book I checked out of the library at the elementary school was a book called Wyatt Earp, U.S. Marshal, and I read it probably 10 or 12 times.
Yeah.
I was obsessed with that book when
I
was a
kid. So it's
sort
of reinforcing the Western hero. But he was sort of a dark guy. He had a dark past as well, didn't he?
Yeah.
Or was he all good?
A lot of these lawmen, particularly up until Elliot Ness, who was the guy that formed the Untouchables, he was another very dark figure, apparently, who was, you know, mythologized by television. Robert Stack and, I'm going to get you, Nitty. The fact is, a lot of these guys got lionized. And to some degree, unjustifiably, but particularly in the Old West, where, you know, they had these people that, like in Unforgiven, the guy that was the writer.
Yeah, he was great.
Yeah, these guys mythologized, Wild Bill Hickok, all of these guys got blown out of proportion because that was, you know, they had people that wrote about them back then, and they just exaggerated.
Yeah, and the thing you were saying was sort of interesting, the thing that's interesting about Tombstone and about a lot of those movies is if the Westerns that took place at the end of the gunfighting period, at the end where you had all these renegades and cowboys and, you know, sort of hotshots that were getting killed by the law or else quitting that life.
Yeah.
And, you know, you were saying that White Earp went on to, you know, get a place and
moved to San Francisco and got married.
And I was, yeah, exactly. You're thinking like
opening a club, all of that.
Yeah, the whole thing.
Well, some of them
married a woman, though.
Some gangsters opened clubs eventually, right?
Sure. Oh yeah.
And you know, I mean, that's just the weird thing about how, like, you know, if they let these guys go crazy for a while and cut the West out and then said, you know, that's it. And they're like, well, I guess I'll just, you know, open a shoe store now. I used to kill people, but what size do you want?
It's like the end of the movie The Searchers, you know. John Wayne finds the girl, brings the girl back to the family.
What do you want me to do? Spell it out for you? Paint you a picture, she's dead. Yeah, go ahead.
But she's not. The last shot in the movie, the family closes the door on John Wayne.
Yeah, and you don't know where that guy's
going.
Come
on, the gunfighter, gone.
Yeah.
See ya.
Well, remember that a lot of stuff was happening all at the same time then, too. Remember that, you know, states like Oklahoma were making that transition from territories to states.
Yeah.
And you had the advent of the automobile, which really did more to end that whole gunfighter thing than any other single thing that happened in America.
There's some great movies that have that in it. I think the Ballad of Cable Hogue, is that what it was called? The Sam Peckinpah movie with Jason Robards, where the automobile shows up and people are like, what?
You know,
what is that? There's no future in that thing. That noisy thing.
That's not a horse.
Yeah, but even in the end of The Unforgiven, like, it says that he went off, and that was sort of based on the White Earp thing, of that they had these gunfighters that, whether they reckoned with their demons or not, they eventually just went and had, you know, regular lives.
Yeah. The great line in there is the kid said he had it coming, and Clint says, we all do, kid.
Yeah. Right. Doesn't end well for anybody.
No, nobody.
All right.
Especially Gene Hackman. God.
He's the best.
What was his name? Little Joe.
He's the best.
Little Bob.
Little Bob. Yeah,
no, whatever. English Bob.
Didn't he say, like, not like this?
You remember
you're going to hell. What was that line that, you know, I'll see you there?
Or I'll whatever. See you there. And then he blew his head off.
You know, I once heard Rod Jeremy say that to Sam Kennison. Honest to God, you know, back in the old days. Well, thanks, Kent, for the impromptu movie review.
Anytime.
Okay, man.
Anytime.
We're going to move into Iraq now. Now, the new Wild West. You can hang out if you want.
There's some striking similarities if you think about it.
That is definitely the Wild
Lawlessness.
West.
Lawlessness.
Yeah.
So now, apparently, President Ghazi al-Yawar told an interview published Monday that the long-term instability and violence in his country could create the conditions for an Iraqi Hitler to emerge. No candidates have been chosen.
No.
But
there are 230 political parties contesting for the job.
I don't want to see the applicants.
Yeah.
Now, you know, Al-Yawar is interesting because he's been very, very low-key. It's been Alawi. The prime minister has been the guy that's out front. Now, interestingly, Alawi is Shiite.
Yeah.
This guy, Al-Yawar, is Sunni. Now, what's interesting about what he's doing, he is criticizing the United States, as several other Iraqi officials have done, particularly Sunnis, for disbanding the army when they overran the country, saying that they should not have disbanded the army. They should have used these elements because now they're trying to reconstruct an army, and obviously when the army are moving targets like they are when people are getting killed 9, 10 at a time, it's a little difficult.
And also a lot of that army that he said we shouldn't have disenfranchised is now fighting for the other side or at least bolstering the insurgency. That becomes a problem. And then he says, this is Ali Yawar says, as soon as we have efficient security forces that we can depend on, we can see the beginning of the withdrawal of forces from our friends and partners. As soon as we see efficient security, I'm assuming he means local police forces, which we have seen no indications of that happening anytime soon.
No, we're not seeing that anytime soon. And remember that this army was 350,000 strong at the time it was disbanded.
God.
Now, had they been able now. Again, you've got to start separating the chaff from the wheat here. On the one hand, you don't want to have Saddam loyalists maintain their position in the Iraqi army. You don't want that to happen.
Yeah.
But you have to ask yourself, how many of those 350,000 troops were actually Saddam loyalists or people that could have been turned had the United States decided to do things differently?
I'll tell you, the possibility of the type of chaos that could lead to another tyrannical regime if the U.S. leaves here is very high. Because if you have this insurgency that, you know, the Islamists and you have the ex-Baathists and you have, you know, the 200 political candidates, I mean, the possibility for civil war if we, you know, if we step out of there, which I assume we will, is pretty high, don't you think?
Well, yeah. And the other problem, of course, is that you've got to have some way to maintain order. That's what he's talking about in terms of an Iraqi Hitler. The idea that the Iraqi people will tolerate a dictatorship, tolerate a despot to restore order to the country.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're afraid of. Now, mind you, a lot of the insurgents look at the Americans as just that. That's part of the problem.
And I think that's going to be Alawi's new campaign slogan. I'm no Hitler. I'm not the new Hitler.
By the way, Al-Yawar also went after the Syrians, which is interesting. He's now saying that the Syrians are major harborers of the insurgency and that the Syrian border, which we all know has been porous for some time, is deliberately porous because he believes that the Syrians would not, that the insurgents wouldn't be able to stay there without the complicity of the Syrian government.
Right on. When we come back, we're going to talk about another Hitler, Pinochet, Augusto Pinochet, or as he calls himself, the Good Angel.
Yeah.
When we come back, and also Rumsfeld, also kind of like, well, you make your own mind up. We'll be back after this on Air America Radio.
Listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Four past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Air America Radio. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to have Congressman Gerald Nadler. He's going to give us an update on the GAO investigation and voting machine inaccuracies and voter fraud, you know, in the wake of the Ohio electors voting to go ahead and secure the election of George W. Bush. Sadly, the protests, you know, at what point they're at now, we will check in as far as on the congressional level where that's what's happening in the future of that with Gerald Nadler. That'll be a good conversation. Right now we have a Palm Pilot here that was brought to us by Ray Ray, who again is going by Ray Ray and now is wearing a New York City police officer's outfit.
Was that what that was?
Yeah, I thought Chris was in trouble. I mean, he just got in here, but it was just he was getting the Palm Pilot. I can't question Ramon. Here we go. Here's Bernie Kerik's Palm Pilot for today.
Oh, no wonder.
8 a.m., wake up, check perimeter for intruders, especially hot babe intruders. Note, fame is a chick magnet. 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., sit around in my undershirt. This is much better than being Homeland Security chief. 1:15 p.m., give illegal immigrant nanny housekeeper a bonus for being the least of my problems. 1:30 p.m., call Giuliani, discuss co-writing article for New York Magazine called Broads, What Are You Going to Do? 3 p.m., call New Jersey Construction Company, tell them to stop sending me gifts. Explain to reporters that sometimes friends in the New Jersey construction business give each other thousands of dollars in cash. 5 p.m. Call both my girlfriends and make two dates for tonight. I got the time. Hell, I'm Bernie Kerik. That's weird.
Boy, he's a comic figure, this guy. He was going to be our Homeland Security boss, and now he's been reduced to a comic figure.
I'll tell you, I saw a cop yesterday over where I was working out. A guy who works out in the same gym came in full uniform, was talking to him. He said that Bernie Kerik would have been the best guy for the job.
Really?
Yeah. And I said, really? I said what you said. And he goes, yeah. There's a lot of things that you guys don't know about. I always love that one.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, we got synchro. You know, I can't tell you what we know.
What we know.
Yeah.
No, look, forget Bernie Kerik.
I have.
The administration has moved on. Fran Townsend. Yeah. I think Asa Hutchinson is probably going to be the guy.
Yeah?
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah. Well, you know who's not going to be new Homeland Security Chief? Augusto Pinochet.
There goes Bush's fashion.
Well, yeah, thank God Pinochet's dead, because now he can wear the jacket with freedom. You know what I mean? Because Bush has his...
Wait a minute, he ain't dead?
I mean, now that he's going to be in jail. Well, he's been out of office for a long time.
House arrest.
But that pseudo bomber waist jacket in the, you know, in the Pinochet gray with the epaulettes and the neocon death cult insignia patch over the breast with the American flag patch on the shoulder and the AWOL blow monkey puppet stitch on the front. Armbands forthcoming, of course, on that.
Yeah,
on
of
those
course.
Outfits.
The motto, I didn't do nothing.
It wasn't me.
Yeah.
So Pinochet, I guess he avoided indictment once before because they said he was, you know, suffering from dementia. But now, you know, even despite the statement where Pinochet told the station, he was being interviewed and he said he sees himself as a good angel. Despite that statement, you know, thank God, you know, there's some long coming justice dished out to this guy.
You know what I find interesting about this? This reminds me so much of Vincent the Chin Gigante.
Yeah.
An alleged organized crime figure who faked mental illness for years before he finally went on trial.
That was the guy who walked around the Lower East Side in his bathrobe.
Yeah.
And slippers, talking to himself.
Yeah. And this is the Southern Hemisphere version of the Chin.
Yeah.
Okay. He's demented. He's this. He's that. Augusto Pinochet is still lucid at the age of 89. He is trying to avoid facing justice for, I mean, I don't know how many hundred people disappeared during the period from 1973 through 1990. 1973, of course, was the year that the elected president of Chile, Salvador Allende, was overthrown. And Pinochet ruled Chile with an iron fist for all of those years.
And that was a coup supported by the Nixon administration because Allende had made public the copper mines and industry, right? I know some of this story, but you know Pinochet was, you know, the worst of the worst, you know, Nixon subsidized, you know,
human rights violators. Yeah, I mean he was really Kissinger was the one that talked Nixon into making sure that Pinochet was backed during the course of this. And of course Allende was killed during the course of the coup. They couldn't afford to let him live at the time.
Right. And this is so they got a Pinochet on they indicted him and placed him under house arrest for the kidnapping of nine dissidents and the killing of one of them during his 1973 to 1990 military regime, which means that, you know, they found the one thing that, you know, they could make stick in this particular thing. Because like you said, he's responsible for killing God knows how many people.
I wouldn't hesitate necessarily to say thousands. But here's the thing, Mark.
Yes.
Over the years when they've gone after Pinochet, because they've been going after him for the better part of 10 years now.
Uh-huh.
In the past, whenever they've talked about taking action against him, his supporters have risen up. There have been huge street demonstrations. There's been a lot of, you know, because he did have a constituency, particularly among the wealthy inside Chile. Well, you'll notice that that's not happening this time around.
Yeah.
There is no big street response to the fact that this judge now says, look, you can, in fact, stand trial. Now, the likelihood is, even if he's convicted, he will probably remain under house arrest. They're not going to put him in a prison. It will, at this point, kill him. Now, I don't know whether that might be justice for some people inside Chile, particularly Salvador Allende's widow, who I believe is still alive.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is they're not going to, you know, they would restrict his movements. That's about the worst that could happen to the guy at this point.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not, you know, just because he's old doesn't mean he shouldn't pay.
Believe me, I am not saying that he needs to pay, because human rights violators like him, like that other wacko in Eastern Europe, I mean, these guys do
Milosevic.
Have to be, huh?
Milosevic.
The guys in Rwanda, mm-hmm. these are people that have to pay.
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds of thousands of lives were lost mm-hmm. for nothing.
Yeah, and the days where you can run on the platform of kill the poor, they're not happening.
Or kill the dissidents, or kill anybody that disagrees with you.
You just do it like this administration. Let the poor die slowly.
Yeah.
Make them believe in you. That's a different platform altogether. Speaking of no confidence in my administration, in our administration, I guess John McCain, Senator John McCain, said that just out and out said he had no confidence in Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld.
In the Rumster.
Yeah, citing Rumsfeld's handling of the war. But he didn't go as far to say that Rumsfeld should resign or that George Bush was any more of an ass for having Rumsfeld on his cabinet. He just basically said no confidence. It's amazing how, you know, these guys remain, their political etiquette is baffling to me. You know, why not just say, you know, get rid of the guy because he's too worried about his own ass, McCain, right?
Well, McCain is looking forward to running for president in 2008. By the way, running largely, at least at the beginning, on the idea of introducing tougher steroids testing in baseball. So he's using sports as his platform. But he's also very careful in his criticism of the Bush administration. He criticizes specific people. He has avoided up until now criticizing the president, saying, well, look, if he wants Rumsfeld, that's what he's got, which is essentially saying it is what it is. And
right.
Any further screw-ups by Rumsfeld, I'm sure he will lay directly at Bush's doorstep.
Well, apparently he's still, you know, he's one of the one of the many who said that, you know, in order to secure the country of Iraq, you know, you're going to need an initial 80,000 to 100,000, you know, more soldiers on the ground. And he was also one of the guys that said we went in with too few and we didn't have an exit strategy. So, you know, this is par for his, you know,
his
war ideology.
Yeah, but now where are they going to get the troops from?
Yeah.
Where? I mean, you're using 40% National Guard and Reserve now.
Well, they're calling up some World War I, World War II veterans that are still alive, and they're using them, too.
World War One.
No.
My God.
Come on,
are
Grandpa.
There any World War I? There are very few. There are still some World War I veterans alive.
Yeah.
They're in their 90s now.
Yeah. Also, he's not the only one. Chuck Hagel is also, offering a pretty solid criticism of Rumsfeld, who's an ass. Chuck Hagel, quote, I don't like the way he has done some things. I think they've been irresponsible. I don't like the way we went into Iraq. We didn't go into Iraq with enough troops. He's dismissed his general officers. He's dismissed all outside influence. He's dismissed outside counsel and advice. And he's dismissed a lot of inside counsel and advice from men and women who have been in military uniforms for 25 and 30 years. Now, that is hardcore, you know, criticism of this ass.
Well, yeah. Now, remember, too, that this criticism is not without context. Rumsfeld is about to fight the battle of his life to maintain his intelligence funding.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that right now the Department of Defense controls 80% of that $40 billion.
Money clearly either he's holding on to or he's certainly not allocating it for, you know, equipping the military properly,
nope.
For guarantee or for making sure that these Humvees get off the production line properly.
Nope.
Where's that money going? Is he just hanging on to it? What the hell is he doing with it?
Well, I don't know that he's actually spending it on intelligence either. That's the other interesting
thing.
Putting
it into the pockets of, you know, military contractors who are overcharging for things that aren't being made.
Halliburton. That could be it. Kellogg Brown and Root, which is a subsidiary, wholly owned subsidiary of Halliburton. Look, these guys are looking out for themselves. Later on, we're going to talk about the fact that Bush is already trying to jumpstart the economic thing, and you got to take a look, Mark, at the list of people that he's got going with him on this.
Yeah,
it's incredible.
Wait, okay, we will. So, you know, we're also going to talk about the Senate Democrats have now decided that they're going to launch an investigation into problems with the Bush administration. The projected time it's going to take to do that is till the end of time. Four past the hour. We'll be back in a second. It's Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on the air and online at morningsedition.com from Air America Radio.
Yes, 49 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Reporting to you from Air America Radio on Morning Sedition. Wow. So, what else, man? It never ends. We're going to talk about that Senate Democrats planning to investigate the Bush administration slowly but surely over time. Well, let's hit that a little bit with Nadler. So let's wait till the top of the 8 o'clock hour. Let's get into this big powwow that Bush is going to have with anybody, his, you know, corporate advisors and people who know how to move money around and
raise money for him.
Yeah.
Now, Mark, what's interesting about this, Bush is jump-starting his second-term economic agenda by holding a conference this week to discuss his key priorities, tort reform, making permanent his tax cuts the Social Security private account system and reining in the federal deficit, which all seem to be a little bit contradictory, but what the hell, we quibble.
So tort reform is, you know, putting caps on potential lawsuits,
yeah,
in order to make provide the corporation with the option of just bottom lining any potential lawsuits, and thus, you know, maybe not making worrying about public safety at all.
Yeah, and also, by the way, making sure that insurance companies have a limit to how much they have to pay out under certain circumstances as well.
So it's all about protecting the insurance companies, the HMOs, and the corporate entities, not about protecting the people of the United States.
Well, when it comes to Social Security, he's also funding his investment banker friends. But take a look at who's going to be
a part of
this conference.
It's like, Grandma, can we go out to the movies? Well, I don't know if I have any money because my Social Security check has been put on black. Go black. Red. Damn.
Now, let's look at who's going to be part of this summit from the private sector, Mark.
Mm-hmm.
Among them, UBS Wealth Management, Time Warner, J.P. Morgan Chase, Dell Computers, Home Depot, Charles Schwab, and economists from Harvard and Yale.
It's weird that they've got everything covered. Everything that, you know, surrounds
common people.
That goes into our head, into our mouth, you know, protects us from, possibly hurting ourselves, and also that, you know, builds our houses.
Yeah. Now, these folks are all, by the way,
surrounded.
They're on the same page with the president. And in fact, Dick Parsons,
yeah,
the chair of Time Warner, was on the committee that Bush named to look at revamping Social Security and came up with the private accounts idea in the first place. So I don't think you're going to hear any dissent from
private
him.
Accounts for Social Security. Now, you know, with Krugman, you know, there's a couple issues around Social Security. In order for Bush to get Social Security privatized, he must convince the public that the system is in imminent danger of collapse.
Yes.
It really isn't. And that we must destroy Social Security in order to save it. However, the system is not in imminent danger. If we don't make a single change to Social Security, the system will remain fully funded and benefits will be fully paid until 2052. Even after 2052, the system won't go bankrupt. It will still be able to pay out 81% of promised benefits. In other words, there is no problem with Social Security, but it's a small problem that calls for some tweaking, not a large problem that calls for a massive government program costing $1 to $2 trillion. Krugman says, quote, very little about the privatizer's position is honest. They come to bury Social Security, not to save it. They aren't sincerely concerned about the possibility that the system will someday fail. They're disturbed by the system's historic success. Social Security is a government program that works, a demonstration that a modest amount of taxing and spending can make people's lives better and more secure, and that's why the right wants to destroy it and put it on red. Come on, red, for grandma's money.
No.
Oh, black.
Too bad. Now, let me tell you a little bit about what's going on here, because it's a really fascinating process.
Because you were asking this before we went on the air. Where exactly is he going to get that money?
Yeah, now it's going to cost $1 to $2 trillion. Nobody seems to be clear about which one it is,
hey,
one or two.
Why quibble over that?
Over a mere trillion. No, bag of shells.
Did I just use a Riley word? Did I just use the word quibble for the first time in my life?
There you go. I'm getting to you.
I know.
Once you go black. Anyway, when you start looking at this stuff seriously, first of all, you realize that the opponents of this private accounts thing have a very big problem on their hands, and I'm not sure they've acknowledged it yet.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little nugget that was in one of the stories we had yesterday, where they talked to a younger guy, 23-year-old guy, who's apparently a talk show host like we are,
mm-hmm,
who said something that was really true. He said, look, all my life, every election cycle, I have heard that Social Security is in imminent danger of collapse, and I believe it. Why? Because I've heard it every election cycle.
It's one of those things. It's one of those talking points.
Bingo.
They reframed it in the last 10 to 30 years. And by repetition, people don't believe it. And also people believe that it's hard to think. You know, I believe our society's got so immediately, you know, gratified, that they've gotten addicted to what's right in front of them. You know, there's very few people that I know, certainly in my business, that really think about the future at all and what could happen. Like, you know, in our game, you sort of got to think like, well, what happens if this doesn't pan out? And
yeah,
everyone thinks they're going to be rich and they're not going to need the Social Security, but believe me,
everybody's going to need the Social Security.
You know, the little extra jack to get you by.
But see, this is the problem.
Yeah.
You've got a generation of people now, ages about 25 to 40, who have been told all their adult lives that this system is not going to be there for them.
Uh-huh.
Therefore, when Bush says, I'm going to create a situation where you can put your own money to work for you, it resonates with them because they've been told the alternative is no benefits or very much lower benefits than the people that are retiring now. The people who are not part of the baby boom generation are the ones that have been tricked by these talking points over time. Now, there is a larger issue here, even than that. And we talked about this a couple times before. There are conservatives in the Bush administration who want to roll back New Deal programs like Social Security. Why?
Bankrupt the government.
No, not just that. They don't believe that the Congress should be allowed to make private employers contribute to Social Security. They have a problem. And see, this is where that whole thing about, you know, Jerry Falwell and these people opening law schools.
Right.
That's the reason why. Yeah. Because these lawyers are now going to go into court and they're going to argue that Congress should not have the right to, and by the way, this is something that was affirmed in 1937.
Right.
Okay. But they are now going to go to court and attack that principle, the principle that Congress should not have the right to force private employers to contribute to Social Security.
Well, that's crazy. Let's talk, hey, Chris, real quick. We play David K. Johnson, the economist that we had on the show the other day. He encapsulates it pretty well.
Yeah, he does.
Here's a simple question. Why do we need a big new government program that will generate all these fees for brokers on Wall Street? Why not simply say, here's your 4 percentage points. You can keep an extra $1,000 a year from Social Security, and you can save it for the future, and you can invest it if you want. You can go spend it, and if you do, well, when you're old and you're hungry and out on the street, we don't care.
Right, but instead, you know, leave it to us because we want to. Yeah, there's that Social Security money. Sorry, Grandma. Oh, no food for you this month.
The Bush administration's biggest enemy on this is the AARP, the American Association of Retired Persons, which has come out four square against these private accounts. And they vote, and they're a large, large organization. And I put the emphasis on organization.
Rightfully so. Here we go. That's the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound coming to us. It's being spat out of the fax machine right now. Here they are. One, strike the words, God bless us, everyone, from A Christmas Carol. We can't budge an inch on this stuff, people. Two, send our soldiers thesauruses to arm them for the upcoming war of words. Three, as a special Christmas treat for your 8-year-olds, make sugar cookies and show them the movie Kinsey. Four, stage nude militant lesbian version of the Nutcracker. Today's phrase is dropping into conversation. You know who poisoned Yushchenko, don't you? It was Bush, man. Wake up. That family will stop at nothing. Nothing, people.
Oh, my goodness.
Congressman Gerald Nadler and the Ohio electors.
Yes.
At the top of the hour.
And the Liberal Confessional coming up here on Air America Radio. Please stay with us.
Your doctor if morning sedition is right for you. Then listen anyway. Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Hi, I'm Mark Maron. You're listening to Air America Radio at 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, delusional self-centered progressives with big secret plans too stupid to share, metrosexual anorexic men, and people that really should either throw out or wash that stinky yoga mat. I want you to understand, folks, that when I say hello to all these different people that, you know, it's really sort of, part of it's kind of real, part of it's kind of supposed to be funny, so don't take it too personally. You know, sometimes you get these emails like, wait a minute, I should throw away my yoga mat. Why is he yelling at me? Hold on a minute. I'm a delusional self-centered progressive with big secret plans too stupid to share. You know what? The hell with this guy. And, of course, Mark Riley is sitting right there in front of me.
Yes.
He gets the big billing. How are you, Mark Riley?
Thank you. I'm doing well. I want to thank the little people.
Oh, don't. The little people are going to get mad now for you calling them little people.
Oh, sorry.
So, look, I'm going to get this dream diary out of the way because we're going to talk to Congressman Nadler in a few seconds.
Yeah.
This is, I'm going to therapy tomorrow. Thank God. All right, so I'm at a manger in Bethlehem. Yeah, you know where this is going, right? It's dark and cold, and I peek my head inside. The place is packed. The three wise men were there listening to their jewel-encrusted iPods, and Frosty the Snowman wearing shades and a diamond medallion that said F to the S, and Clay Aiken was singing Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas while his stupid hair stuck straight up, and all the desperate housewives were exposing themselves to the wise men who weren't buying it because they could see how desperate they were, and the football refs and the Miller Beer ads were beating one tired joke into the ground, and there were donkeys and sheep, and Joseph and Mary were wondering if all these people were going to be hungry and if they should order takeout. Inside the crib was a plasma screen TV with a high-definition image of the baby Jesus. It made me want one. Not Jesus, the TV. One of the wise men turns to me and says, didn't you bring a gift? You have to bring a gift, man. Wow, major faux pas. I say, hey, buddy, look, I'll play my drum for him. But there's already five little drummer boys lined up, and it's getting pretty chaotic in there because none of them are on the same beat. I kick out a little, yeah. Suddenly I'm surrounded by 20 busty little elves in red and green wonder bras. They take me down the road to another manger, which had a fairly strict dress code and a steep cover charge. Luckily, I had on the right shoes. I danced all night with one of the elves, and by morning, we were in love. I said, sweetheart, come live with me, and as God is my witness, you'll never have to work for that fat bastard at the North Pole again. We married and had 13 children who were ridiculed for their pointy heads. Oh, I woke up and my bed was filled with tinsel.
Whoa.
Yeah, what are you going to do, man? You know, that's rough sometimes. You know, things get weird in my head.
I can tell, man. They had a little Unforgiven in there.
They get a little peculiar up there. So right now I'm very excited to have our next guest on. He and other Democrats from the House Judiciary Committee have been pushing to keep the investigation of Ohio open. Yesterday, the request to delay the Electoral College vote was denied. The big question is, what happens now? Congressman Jerry Nadler, good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here. Before we get immediately into the electoral thing, can I just ask you about this, that Senators Harry Reid and Byron Dorgan announced they're going to hold hearings to reinvigorate Senate oversight of the federal government. Now, will you guys do anything somewhere in the House?
Well, I don't know, although, of course, these hearings that we're having about Ohio right now are such hearings.
Sure. Okay. Well,
they're not authorized by the committee. We don't have the power to subpoena, but they're Democratic minority hearings.
Great. So now what's going on now? Why did you write to let's get into specifics here. Why did you write Ohio Governor Bob Taft to delay the state's electoral vote in the first place, and did you feel that there was a chance to change the outcome?
Well, I think the chances of changing the outcome are very small, if existent at all. But the fact of the matter is that under Ohio law, you're supposed to hold a recount if demanded properly according to law. The recount was demanded properly according to law. They're going to hold the recount, but they certified the election before the recount. The Ohio Secretary of State, Mr. Blackwell, who's done everything he can to set up a one-sided election, deliberately delayed and dragged his feet on starting the recount, which actually technically started yesterday, the same day they certified the election results. I mean, if you're going to have a recount, you're going to do it before you certify the results, not after.
Right. So now, how did he do this? How did Blackwell? How does his actions conflict with the state recount laws?
Well, he just dragged his feet in doing it. In other words, the law provided that the electors were supposed to meet and cast their votes yesterday, and he by a series of steps, just delayed starting the recount.
Yeah.
Now, Congressman, is there any conflict from where you sit in Kenneth Blackwell being both Secretary of State and overseeing this process and also being state campaign chair of Bush Cheney 2004?
Well, I don't know if it's a legal conflict, but it's certainly a moral conflict. And remember, Catherine Harris had the same conflict in Florida 4 years ago, and there may be other secretaries of state that have that conflict. I don't know. But it surely does not give anyone any confidence in the impartiality of the rulings of the person running the election process, and that person is also the campaign chairman for one of the candidates. That's an obvious conflict of interest.
Now, you mentioned earlier that your committee doesn't have subpoena power. It's a minority.
No, the committee has subpoena power. The minority does not.
Oh, the minority. Okay. Now, did Democrats treat Republicans that way when Democrats controlled Congress? I'm curious.
Well, I was only in Congress 2 years with Democrats control, so I don't really know. But I do know that the Republicans have practically shut down the oversight function of Congress. Some of their leaders have said, we don't want to embarrass the administration. When we had a Democratic president and Democratic Congress, oversight nonetheless was plentiful. Go back through the clippings, and you'll find that there was a lot of oversight, a lot of criticism of how this department or that department is doing something. That's completely changed under this Congress. We've, for all practical purposes, shut down oversight, and that's a very, very bad thing for the country.
So getting back to Blackwell now, if you said that he did everything he could to make this a one-sided election, all right, and all the anomalies that we're going to talk about after the break, you know, favored Bush, how can we be sure that Senator Kerry, you know, didn't win?
Well, until the detailed recount is completed, you can't be sure.
Right.
But I think the large number of votes, the 119,000 plurality, makes it probable that the allegations we've heard, with one exception, which I'll come to, simply wouldn't rise to the numbers to make 119,000 votes.
So,
the one exception is the fact that we heard testimony from a computer expert that, of course, when you're dealing with these electronic voting machines without a paper trail, someone who knows what he's doing could just completely falsify the election to any number, and no one would ever know that afterward.
Well, that's disturbing and horrifying, and we're going to talk about...
There's not evidence that someone did it.
Right.
At least not yet.
Well, you know, let's talk about more of the other things that they did after this. So we're talking to Congressman Gerald Nadler, and we'll be back on Air America Radio. It's 13 past the hour.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Courtesy of Air America Radio.
It's Morning Sedition. You're listening to Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley. It's 19 past the hour.
Yes, it is.
On the phone from New York City is Congressman Gerald Nadler. He and other Democrats from House Judiciary Committee have been pushing to keep the investigation of Ohio open. And yesterday, they requested delay. The Electoral College vote was denied. Congressman Nadler, tell me about this computer expert, his credibility, what he had to say.
Well, with this computer expert say, his credibility, I don't know because I've never heard of him before.
And this is Clinton Curtis?
What?
Is this Clinton Curtis?
I think that was his name.
Okay.
I don't recall. He stated several things. He stated, number one, that with these electronic voting machines hooked up to tabulators, to countywide tabulators, that any really competent computer person could put an instruction in source code into the computer to do anything, to cut the Democratic vote in half, to multiply it by three, to eliminate every fifth Democratic vote, to switch a vote from Kerry to Bush, or vice versa, and you'd never be able to tell it afterwards. I asked them specifically that, well, people who worried about that were called conspiracy theorists on the grounds that you would have to have thousands of people in on the conspiracy to contaminate thousands of machines.
Yeah.
And he said, no, that's not true. All you would need is one person to contaminate the tabulating machine in a county or a state. And I said, well, couldn't you then compare the different numbers on that tabulating machine and on the individual machines? He said, no, because they communicate with each other, and you could program the tabulating machine to tell the individual machines to change their stories, in effect. And unless you took it apart and an expert went into source code, you would never be able to find that it had happened, and you might not even be able to find it then, depending how good the programmer was.
So is
in other words, that it's totally unprotected.
Right.
He also testified,
yes,
by the way,
mm-hmm,
and this we have no corroboration from, but if it's true, it's very serious, that 4 years ago he worked for a company that did a lot of the computer work for Florida, and that the then Speaker of the Florida House, is now a congressman,
mm-hmm,
asked his company to come up with code to, in effect, steal the election. And that he was instructed by his superior, and he came up with the code, but he assumed it was to protect the elections. He came up with code to show how you could contaminate it and how to protect against it. And his boss said, no, they don't want it to protect against it. They want to steal it.
So we don't – now, do we have any evidence of actual wrongdoing, you know, in Ohio?
Actual wrongdoing, yes, but none of this type.
Not of the computerized type, but you – and
well, there's only indirect evidence. There was also a witness who testified that the odds of the exit polls being substantially different from the votes are 1 in 180 million, and that therefore there's something wrong either with somebody either tampered or something was deliberately done either to the exit poll or to the voting results.
Well, and what are some of those things that you saw happen that need to be changed? Because I'm trying to figure out...
Well, for example, I'll give you three or four examples.
Okay.
One, there was a clear pattern that in Democratic areas, especially in minority and black areas,
right,
you had many fewer voting machines per number of voters than in other areas. You had 5 and 10 hour waiting lines to vote, whereas in Republican areas, you didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a question. question of misallocation, deliberate or otherwise, of machines by the Secretary of State and the people who work for him.
Mm-hmm.
There was also the allegation there were 70 or so extra machines in areas where there were long voting lines that they didn't bother using. They kept them in the warehouse. Secondly, we heard statements from one group that had gathered a lot of registrations over the year that turned them in once a week, that kept Xerox copies of the registrations they turned in, and then hundreds of them simply disappeared, never got into the rolls. When people went to vote, they weren't there. They then voted on a provisional ballot, which was then ruled invalid after the election because there was no registration against which to validate it, and then hundreds or thousands of these registrations simply disappeared.
Mm.
We heard information or allegations that there was a deliberate disinformation campaign conducted in certain minority areas where people were told by people at the door, by people by phone, that, you know, you'd better not vote if you can't have certain kinds of proof of your ID because it's a felony and we'll arrest you. Or people were told that the election was postponed a day or two. I mean, almost silly-sounding stuff, but apparently worked to prevent certain voting.
Congressman Nadler, what would be an acceptable margin of error here when this recount is done? Right now, the count shows Bush in Ohio up by about 119,000. That was after all the provisional ballots were counted. How much
error? All the provisional ballots that they recognized as valid.
As valid, yeah. How much error is okay? If this recount, for example, cuts that number in half, then what do you do?
Well, first of all, they're going to recount 3% of the precincts, apparently. If that shows a reason of a certain error rate, then they have the right to demand a recount of everything. And obviously, you can only, I'm not sure what you can do now that the electors have voted, but you can call it into question on January 6th if the recount were to show that in fact Kerry won the state, then you could protest it. Short of that, I don't see how you could protest it. But of course, the issue isn't simply does this recount going to show an error of 119,000 votes. I think that's highly unlikely, as I said before. The issue is, even if 40 or 50,000 people were denied their votes properly, or their votes didn't count, or something else happened, that's terrible, and we have to make sure, not only for the integrity of this election, but for future elections, that we put safeguards in place to see this kind of thing doesn't happen.
What kind of safeguards?
Well, for one thing, this anyone who's running the election should not be partisan in the sense of being an official of one of the election committees. Second of all, we must have, with these new electronic voting machines, we must have a paper trail so you can recount it and check it against it. Right now, the only thing you get is a statement by the machine that this was the vote. If you recount, yes, or another statement, you get the same thing. There is no assurance whatsoever. Thirdly, we have to have some sort of protections so that people who register to vote, we know that they are in fact registered. If there's a 2% error rate, that's 2% too many. Thirdly, we ought to have standards that for every X number of voters, you must have a machine so
yeah.
that you don't have a discrepancy. I think Congress ought to pass a statute for national voting standards for federal elections within our constitutional power to do so, and we have to do so, and take some of this discretion away from state officials.
All right, well, thank you for joining us, Congressman Nadler.
You're quite welcome.
Appreciate it.
Great talking to you. Always very informative. We'll talk to you again. Wow, okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, that was very, very interesting right. because they went into a great deal of detail in these hearings.
Yeah. Sometimes it's not easy being a liberal, Mark. You know that, right? We all stray from the straight and narrow from time to time, but when we need to unburden ourselves, we can always confess our liberal sins. If you want to take a turn in the liberal confessional, give us a call at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. But right now it's my turn. Bless me, Brother Riley, for I have sinned.
How can I ease your burden, my son?
Well, you know I love my wife.
Of course.
Well, you know, my wife and I are on different coasts, and I miss her a lot, and, you know, sometimes, you know, I get lonely.
Yeah?
What I'm trying to say is, Mark, is I love porn.
Mark, pornography is something that takes the most tender and sacred of human acts and removes it of all intimacy.
I know. Isn't it great?
Mark!
What? I'm sorry, I know. Look, every time I watch porn, I feel guilty. I feel guilty because it fosters cultural sexism and it isolates me. It taints my mind. It gives me porn eye for days on end. I feel guilty about how women are presented. They're completely dehumanized. But, you know, sometimes dehumanization is such a turn-on.
Mark!
What?
When we objectify and degrade our fellow humans, we are suppressing a deeper spiritual consciousness.
All right, well, look, a deeper spiritual consciousness is great, but it just doesn't turn me on the same way. It's much harder to get off, okay? What should I do, Mark?
Mark, you have to remember that there is no such thing as a solitary action, even when it comes to watching porn. And you're not just objectifying women. When you support porn, you are being objectified as well.
How so? What do you mean?
I mean that when you download porn on your computer or order it on cable or in your hotel room, you are giving financial support to the media monopolies that wish to dehumanize us and objectify us all as docile, submissive consumers.
In other words, the biggest money shot of all is corporate profit.
Exactly. As your penance, you must abstain from porn for a month, and during that month, you must watch at least 3 Lifetime movies a week, all the way through, and no touching.
Oh, man, wait, not even the movies with Melissa Gilbert?
No!
Valerie Bertinelli?
No!
Oh, that's...
Now go forth and sin no more.
Harsh, man.
Amen.
You know, Riley, thank you for my penance.
No charge.
And if anyone else out there wants to confess and seek absolution in our liberal confessional, you can give us a call right now at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270, and we'll see what we can do.
Yeah, now, listen, this time, maybe we don't want to get the I just yelled at a conservative kind of thing. That's a nice confessional, but we've heard a lot of them lately. Let's try some other stuff for a change. What do you say, Maron?
Deep, dark secrets. What
do
you got?
Yeah, man. Any of you carry guns? I like those kind of confessions.
Anything, anything. We'll take anything, really. 866-303-2270. We'll talk to you in a minute. Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley on Morning Sedition.
Oh, yeah.
It's confession time, 866-303-2270. What do you got on your mind? What's eating at you? Here we go, Brad in Pismo Beach.
Pismo Beach.
How are you, Brad?
I'm conflicted, my father's.
Oh, what's the matter, buddy?
I have to confess that I bought an SUV this week.
Oh, that's a bad one. How big of an SUV, Brad?
It's a midsize. It's not one of the giant ones. It's not one of the dinky ones.
So you did make a little bit of a compromise in your choice.
I did.
And how many blocks to the gallon does this thing get?
Well, it actually does pretty good. It's a 6-cylinder SUV. I bought it because I run deliveries every night, and I needed something that was going to... That was going to hold everything, but I'm still conflicted.
So you needed it for your job. You've got a medium-range SUV. It's got a 6-cylinder engine. You made some concessions. It sounds like you did okay. I understand your conflict. Well, I think that your penance should be, occasionally, when the spirit moves you, just to stop at a bus stop and pick a few people up and take them to where they're going.
There it is. What do you think?
Wow. Hey, cool.
Free ride. There you go.
There's somebody right there. I'll pick him up.
Okay.
Just hope the Pismo Beach Taxi Commission.
He seemed to be a little sarcastic with that. Maybe you should just take your friends in a carpool.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, Brad. Thanks, man. Thanks. All right. I hope that helped him out. Here we go. Kirk. How you doing, Kirk?
What's up, Atlanta? Kirk?
Hey, good morning, guys.
How you doing, man?
I'm all right, but I'm a little bit conflicted myself. Yeah. I'm looking for some help from you boys.
Yeah. Sure.
I have been reading Pat Buchanan's weekly column.
Oh, boy.
I know. Yeah. And he makes sense in about half of them.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I have to agree with about half of them because I'm married and I have children, and my views have changed a lot.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I think Riley can help you out. Give us a little history of Pat Buchanan quickly.
Pat Buchanan is the guy who said that Washington, D.C. was a much better place when it was segregated.
Yeah.
Back in the day.
Yeah,
Pat Buchanan didn't even think that the 1964 Civil Rights Act, an act that, as far as I know, has harmed no one in 40 years, that it never should have been passed. Is that Pat Buchanan you're talking about?
That's the same one, but I don't agree with those views.
Okay, well, Kirk, I think maybe if you find some of the views that you agree with in Pat Buchanan, he probably stole them from somewhere else.
What other views does he hold?
He is really against the neocons, and he thinks they're bad for America.
Oh, but that's good, so you don't have to attribute that to him.
Yeah, and he has some pretty strong immigration views. He goes over the top, but if Mexicans couldn't find jobs here, they wouldn't come here, and he's got a point in that. So
it's
artificially driving down the cost of labor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay.
I'm not saying that he's not insane, because he's obviously insane, but... I do agree with some of the things that he says, and I don't feel good about that. I have a hard time with that.
Well, I think that maybe some of the views that he's saying that you agree with are also, you know, out there in the world that necessarily they're not necessarily attached to Pat Buchanan. I think you should detach those views from Pat Buchanan, let him go because he's an ass. I know sometimes he, you know, it seems like he, you know, he's got his act together and that he's, you know, tough on things, but he's really an ass. And what's the other thing you want
wait,
to say?
Wait. I got a penance for him.
Okay.
I got a penance for you, Kirk.
Okay.
The director's cut of Ralph Nader on the Road.
There you go.
Okay.
Buy it, watch it,
okay.
Live it.
What's the other confession, though?
Oh, the other confession, I'm not sure I really want to say it on the air now.
Go ahead, say it. Come on.
It's personal. Okay, sometimes in the morning, after my wife has left with the kids, I turn on Fox in the Morning to Edie Hill's legs. And I mean, she's smart, she's hot. I have a thing for her. What can I do?
Well, as long as you're masturbating for the wrong reason.
Yeah.
Oh, no. That's not going
on. No, that's not in his program. See, this is
not in my program.
This is not the masturbatory.
My wife and I sleep in the same bed.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Not for long if she finds out about this.
Well, you see, but yeah.
All right. I didn't mean to imply anything. But,
yeah.
All right, well, I guess your penance on that one is, you know, just to, what do you think, Mark?
Maybe watch a Sissy Spacek movie.
Ooh, that's tough.
All right,
ooh.
Kirk, thanks for calling, buddy.
All right.
All right, man.
Easy.
I saw her on TV last night. That's the only reason why I mentioned Sissy Spacek.
We'll take some more if you want. 866-303-2270. 866-303-2270. Greg in New Haven, what's going on?
Hey, Greg.
Good morning.
How are you doing, man?
Good. Well, after years of preaching to others against the evils of Walmart and encouraging them not to shop there and actually embarrassing them if they do,
mm-hmm.
On a road trip, my sister and I broke down and actually shopped at one while on vacation a couple months ago.
Oh, wow. How'd you feel? Dirty? Excited? What?
Well, this is the problem.
Yeah.
I was a little excited. And what's worse is that since then, I really want to go back. I'm attracted to the low prices and the associates with the blue...
Yeah, it's dangerous.
You got a thing for the associates?
The associates with the blue, I can't remember what the thing is that they wear, the vest.
Yeah, the weird thing, you get a taste, it's like crack. Because, you know, you walk in, it's just overwhelming, you're like, oh my God, I can get anything for almost nothing. I think your penance has got to be, you know...
I know what his penance is.
Oh, what do you got for him?
Greg, you live in New Haven, right?
I sure do, where they're building them everywhere.
Okay, now I got your penance. Can you spell bodega? You know what a bodega is, right?
I don't.
You don't? They got bodegas in New Haven? Anyway, it's a small Spanish supermarket. They sell everything that Walmart does, only for about 50% higher.
Yeah.
You got to go and spend at least $20.
I'm there.
In a bodega.
The great thing also about shopping at some bodegas is, you know, sometimes you don't know really what's going on in the bodega.
Or what it is that you're buying.
Yeah. So you get the thrill of maybe being in the crossfire of some sort of, you know, strange criminal act. You know, because that... And also buying overpriced merchandise.
Yeah, and don't mind the pit bulls. It's okay.
And you might also want to just, you know, maybe once shop at one of the smaller family-owned businesses like Sears or Kmart.
Yeah.
I'll do that.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, Greg.
See you later.
Sin no more.
All right, what else?
Uh-oh, we got somebody else in Connecticut, do we?
This is fun.
Yeah.
All right, Chris in Connecticut, what's going on?
What's up, Chris?
I've been living with a terrible burden for 20 years.
Oh, my God. Uh-oh. That's deep.
When I lived in New York 20 years ago and was working the polls
yeah.
at the 1984 election.
Yeah.
An elderly lady with poor vision couldn't make out the levers in the booth.
Yeah.
She wanted to know which was the lever for Reagan.
Yeah.
And myself and the Republican attendant went into the booth to help her, but
yeah.
it turned out the Republican attendant wasn't Republican, just poor.
Okay.
Registered Republican every year for the, I think it was $65 back then.
Oh, wow.
That you get for a day's work.
Yeah.
So it was left for me to pull the lever.
Yeah,
and you pulled it for Fritz Mondale, didn't you?
No, I didn't.
You pulled it for Reagan?
That's where the burden comes in. Yes, I did the right thing.
Oh, see, this would have put Fritz over the top.
So you're actually, you did the right thing, and you feel bad for doing the right thing.
Oh, I felt terrible for 20 years.
Well, I guess you can rest reassured that it probably wasn't that vote that put him over the top. But, you know, I guess, you know what, you're going to have to go out and do a bad thing for an old person. There's only one way to counteract this, Chris.
Yeah.
It's going to probably be more painful than the actual action you took the first time.
Yep.
Take it easy. Thanks for calling, Chris.
Man.
We'll talk to you. We'll take a few more of these after the break. Yeah, 866-303-2270 if you want to confess.
Confess.
The poor guy's been carrying the burden of doing the right thing for 20 years. It's 42 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition. Call us at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley on Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Yeah.
We're taking your confessions at 866-303-2270. Had some guy confess to doing the right thing and just plaguing him for 20 years.
Yeah.
That was beautiful. If you missed it, you missed something funny. Jim in San Francisco listening to The Quake.
Hey, Jim.
Hey, guys.
What's up, buddy? What kind of burden are you carrying on your heart there today?
Well, you know, I generally oppose the death penalty, but I think in Scott Peterson's case, we need to ram through these appeals in time for him to drag across from the ferry building up Market Street and crucify that son of a...
Oh, good.
Wow.
You bleeped yourself.
On Good Friday.
Wow, biblical stuff going on there, huh?
But
what's up with that?
It sounds to me that you're setting it up for that maybe, you know, thousands of years from now that you might deify Scott Peterson if you're not careful.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I look at the short term. It'd be a good kickoff for the tourist season.
Oh, God. How long would you leave him up?
Well, 3 days.
Let
the vultures pick the bones clean.
Wow. Why do you think you've shifted so dramatically from your philosophical standing on the death penalty, your moral standing with this particular case?
This is a sin of thought. I'm conflicted. I'm burdened. Okay.
Yeah.
And but this guy is just a total sleaze.
Yes.
I mean, total.
Psychopath, sociopath, unconscious, he has no conscience. Yeah, I understand what you're saying. It's a tough penance.
The other thing is that we don't know that the Uber governor might not, you know, let him out of jail sometime. And if he's dead, that's one guy who's not going to kill anybody again.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So you're really ready to needle him up, huh?
He's ready to crucify him, Mark.
Oh, you really want to crucify him?
Yeah. I really want to crucify him. Wow.
Well,
I guess, you know, your penance is difficult, but you're going to have to forgive him.
Wow. That's a tall order, huh?
It is.
Well, right. Think about
it's gotta
it.
It's got to be in San Francisco because Modesto has no hills.
So I guess the penance didn't work out. So you want to maybe right on top of Twin Peaks there, right where the big tower is and the radio tower?
Yep.
Well, wow. You know, it doesn't sound to me like penance is...
Mount Davidson Cross is too big.
Wow.
Right, it is too big. He's just a man.
You really thought this out, haven't you, Jim?
Yeah, I don't think you're...
I was on hold for a while.
Yeah. I don't think you're in the mood to hear any penance.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that as a person who's against the death penalty, you're going to need to either forgive Scott Peterson, or if you do crucify him, you're going to have to worship him for a few days.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
You got to get back
to... I forgive you, Scott. I forgive you.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. That was pretty big. That was big. That's a spiritual giant there.
Something tells me Scott Peterson's not listening. I don't think he can stream us. I don't know. Maybe he could get us on the Quake, but...
Oh, okay. So now what do we got here? We got Mark in Missouri. Mark, how are you? Missouri. You listening to Sirius. What's on your mind?
Yeah. Okay. Blue heart here in a red state, and I'm starting to have deep Republican thoughts.
Oh, my God.
I need penance.
Okay, that happens, man.
Yesterday, went to the gas pump. It's $1.53 here.
Whoa.
And I've also dropped 10 cents in 3 days, and also have read in the news that 10 soldiers have died in the past 3 days in Iraq, and I'm thinking like a Republican. A few more hundred, a few more thousand, whatever the percentage is in relation to troops being killed and gas falling, we can get that gas price down below a dollar.
Wow, that's pretty heartless, Mark.
That's
wow. Republican.
That's some dark. That's some dark stuff there.
It's deep Republican.
It's deep Republican. It's ideologically, core Republican. You've gone pretty deep. So I hate to tell you this, but you're going to have to walk to work.
Yeah.
For at least a month or until you really understand, what's going on again, and perhaps you might have to carry the cross with Scott Peterson on it, with you to work on your back.
If I thumb, will it be acceptable to take a ride in an H2 Hummer?
Never.
It's a whole different issue because you could get into that car and start discussing your beliefs with the guy who drives that car, and you'll find an agreement there. And the next thing you know, you're voting Republican. Now I've just changed it. You got to walk with no shoes.
I will do it.
Okay,
thank you, Mark.
Call. Good luck with
my
everything.
Brothers.
Yes, yes.
People are really into this. It's starting to scare me.
Yeah, that was he was in a dark place.
Yeah, really.
Okay, all right. So let's just take. Well, we got time for a quick one. Michael is streaming in New York. How are you, Michael?
No, I think this is Jack.
Oh, Jack. How are you, Jack?
Yo, Jack.
Hi. What's going on?
I have a confession that sometimes when I hear how Bush is destroying the environment, I get a little satisfaction because I think of all the Naderites and Green voters I beg to vote for Kerry or Gore.
Oh, really? So you get satisfaction when you know the environment's being destroyed because you think they screwed up the vote.
Yeah, I mean, I know it's wrong of me to feel good about it, but it's just, it hurts so much when I'm begging these voters, look, just,
Yeah, just do the right thing so we can get this guy out of office, and they didn't listen to you.
Right, and they thought that it would help the environment, and look how bad it's getting hurt.
Well, you live on Staten Island?
Yeah.
Well, so you're already doing your penance.
You're correct.
Whoa. Okay. I don't know if Kalo's buying into that one.
I'm kidding.
You okay?
I think that what you're going to have to do is, I think for the next couple of weeks, just take a hike up that dump hill.
Fresh kills?
And stand on top of it, take a few deep breaths, and walk down, all right?
I'll do that.
All right, Jack. Thanks for calling.
Walk down if you can after taking a few deep breaths.
I'm sorry about Staten Island.
Yeah, whatever.
Come on, what are you doing?
Yeah, that happened.
It is what it is. No one's ever made that joke before. Every Tuesday, we bring you the latest news from the front lines of the 4-year global war being waged by the Bush administration. Here with today's dispatch from the War on Brains is war correspondent Mort Milfington.
Dateline, Washington, D.C., home of the National Archives, and the only surviving copy of the Declaration of Bill of Rights, proclamation for patent of the light bulb. Look, there was a fire, and they had to piece together what they had left. Thursday, December 14th, the barbarians are at the gates, ladies. The siege has begun. Our once beautiful land trembles with the very footfall of a great race of idiot giants. Reptilian iguanodons who feed off the stupefying succulent goo that endlessly flows from the spigot of Rupert Murdoch, Rudolph Giuliani, and that fat cow, Sara Lee. Pressing grimly on, this menace will not be satisfied by poisoning our drinking water, will not even be satiated by making someone as personally irritating as Jon Stewart into a star. No, now they have even inflicted the greatest indignity possible, making our educational system into the laughingstock we always knew it was. For according to the Program for International Student Assessment, or PISA, compared with their peers in Europe, Asia, and other regions our military hasn't destroyed yet, American 15-year-olds fall well below average when it comes to applying math skills to real-life tasks. Shameful. Ignominious. Yeah, I remember when I was 15 and we were below average then. I mean, how effective a student can you possibly be when the only math skill you're interested in applying to a real life task is adding your face to the French teacher's breast? Why, I still get an embarrassing erection whenever I see a chalkboard, which probably explains why they won't let me teach again. Yes, U.S. students were behind most other countries in geometry, algebra, statistics, and even word pronunciation. Yes, why American kids have such a poor command of math, they don't even know this is the last day of the Festival of Lights. Which brings me to my next point, Mark. Thanks a lot for the Hanukkah present.
I didn't get you anything, Mark.
No kidding, Santa Claus.
But you're not Jewish, buddy.
Yeah, but you are.
I don't see what this has to do with the poor math skills, Mort.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mark. Maybe a simple equation will help you out. Big star plus bloated salary equals, equals, let me see, oh yeah, cheapskate.
Oh, all right. Look, I'm sorry, Mort. I didn't know you felt that way. How about this? If you're not doing anything, my wife and I would like you to come over for holiday dinner.
Dinner? Why, I'm very touched. Before I answer that, Mark, I'd like to show my appreciation by giving you this verbal gift. As I cut my hands, I speak into it and say the words,
I like you. Well, thanks, Mort. That's very sweet. Now, how about coming over for dinner? What do you say?
No, thanks, Mark. You creep me out. Me sitting at your dinner table, staring at your giant poster of Michael Bolton.
What?
Your Xanadu. Count me out. And that's today's dispatch room. The War on Race.
Wow. Yeah, that was great, Mort.
That was deep.
That's terrific. Yeah, thanks for...
Thank you.
Yeah, that's great. It's always good to see you. You know, I was feeling good about myself, and, you know, thanks, man.
Can I just say one last thing?
I guess.
Free Scott Peterson.
It's all circumstantial.
Yeah, have a good day.
Whatever.
All right. Wow, there you go.
I don't know if Mort's going to do the Scott Peterson thing for so long. You know,
he has a point, I guess, on some level that it is all circumstantial evidence, but, you know, the jury decided, and that's that.
He's got his hot shot waiting. We'll see. Not in our lifetime. So
Mike Birbiglia is coming up. Funny guy.
Yeah. His new CD is Dog Years. We'll hear about that and more when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Ask your doctor if morning sedition is right for you. Then listen anyway. Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
I'm Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, festering progressives, latent haters, adolescents, dope fiends, ex-dope fiends, all of you people, the guilt-ridden, good morning to you. Nice to talk to you. Mark Riley, how are you, sir?
I'm doing okay, and I'm not too guilty. Not as guilty as our callers from the last segment.
Oh, that made me feel better, man. You know what I mean? I love doing that segment. That liberal confessional is great. I mean, I get something off my chest, they get something off their chest. We, you know, we work it out. It's beautiful. It's the way it should be, Mark.
Yeah, but that last guy creeped me out with that whole thing about, you know, the rising gas, the falling gas prices and the rising soldiers getting killed.
It was a deep, dark one, man. That happens. When you open up the booth, you don't know what's going to come in.
Well,
I got a confession. I got another confession.
Really?
This is. I'll tell you, man.
That's not the only booth you've been opening.
No, dude, that ain't it. I gave one of my cats away yesterday, man.
Oh, you did?
I gave one of the cats away.
You gave it to the Yemeni guy?
I gave it to Yemeni guy across the street. It was hard, but I got to be honest with you. The meanest. She's not mean, but she was the most wild, the most the most feral of my four feral cats. I had her fixed, you know, and I couldn't warm, you know, I took her over there, I got her into the cage, it was very hard getting her into the cage, I put her downstairs over at the store, I left the cage there, I opened it, he put out some food, and that's it. And I went home, and I gotta be honest with you, my other three cats are like new cats. They are, like, completely different.
So this was the instigator.
I don't know if it was an instigator, but because of her skittishness and how wild she was, the general vibe was, like, if I walk into the room, she would be like, ah, you know, and all the other ones here, well, okay, you know. So they were all kind of, like, operating at that same pitch all the time. Literally, within hours of this cat being out of the house, they were just kind of lounging around, hanging out. I'd walk right up to them and be like, hey, what's going on? They're like, nothing.
There you go. You got domesticated cats. But see,
I don't know about that, but they're getting closer.
What was the name of the wild one you gave away?
Meanie.
Meanie. Well, Meanie. Meanie is now having mouse a la mode for breakfast.
Yeah, you know, I started to think about it, and I had to make a lot of phone calls because I needed a lot of support around this. You know, I wish I were kidding. I wish, like, you know, what? Because I sat there, Mark, and I was looking at the cat, and I made myself a big, you know, vat of, you know, fat-free popcorn because I'm, you know, ridiculous. So I'm sitting there with all this popcorn, you know, getting, you know, trying to get it together to do this. It's like I was preparing for a mob hit or something. I wasn't drinking shots to, like, you know, kill somebody. I'm sitting there eating popcorn saying, I'm going to be able to get this cat in a cage and take it across the street.
Was it difficult to actually get her inside?
It always is. Yeah. I have to put leather gloves on. She almost bit through the leather glove. I mean, wow. You can't pick her up. It's really difficult. The only thing that I feel good about, aside from, you know, detaching from this cat, is that, you know, I did have her fixed. The guy across the street's a good guy. I can go visit her if I want, if she doesn't get out, which she might. But, you know, if she does get out and that's where she wants to be because she's a wild cat, I do know that she's not going to be producing more feral cats. And I feel like, you know,
you did a good thing.
I unburdened myself a little bit, but it was hard. But I do feel better because these other cats seem a lot more docile and happier without the energy of this cat in the house.
Wow. Yeah. Cat karma.
This is a huge step considering if you're a regular listener and you realize the saga of this cat thing, because it was really hard for me because I got very attached to this cat even though it didn't like me. You know what I mean? And then I had this weird moment where I felt sort of, you know, like I was like a Republican ruler. Like I was like, I will get rid of the one that doesn't agree with me.
There you go.
You know what I mean? The one that doesn't buy my program, I will get rid of her.
Bush the cat.
Yeah. But no, it wasn't that. I mean, it was the right thing to do because I only wanted two to begin with. And I've been, you know, I've had these cats for how long now? Like 6 months.
So now you're down to two.
No, I got three.
You still got three.
But I couldn't, I got the little one, the runt, is the cutest cat, and was also latched on to Meanie. So she was also like this very aggressive wild cat because she, you know, it was a dominating personality and she just followed the whatever that one did. I got her in a cage and I was going to give her away and I just couldn't do it because Monkey, the male cat, when I first found, this is ridiculous, listen to me, when I first found them, they were so entwined and so connected that I didn't want to separate them. And when I put LaFonda, the little one, in the cage, Monkey got up on the cage and was like, what's up? Where are you
really?
Going? Yeah. So I was like, oh my God, I can't take it. So I what is wrong with me? So Mimi had to go and she's gone and I'm not going to go over there until I'm going to wait a few days because I just can't handle it. So that's what's going on with me and the cats, and that's it's a big breakthrough. And you know, if you think I'm a wuss, fine. I do appreciate the support I did get from people. Like we got a phone call on our message on our phone message thing. Some girl from Seattle. She's like, she just basically said they're going to be huge soon. You're going to have to do this now.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's where I'm at. So let's talk about this. We didn't really talk about it too much about the new Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid. Said Monday his party will launch investigative hearings next year in response to what he said was the reluctance of Republicans to look into problems in the Bush administration. Obviously, they're not going to look into any problems. They're all feeding on it right now. It's all, you know, there's a shutdown. There's a lockdown on congressional committees looking into their problems, isn't there?
Well, there is a shutdown, and certainly the Republicans will do everything they can, as they did with the hearings that John Conyers held, and that the House Judiciary Committee continues to hold on the irregularities in Ohio. They're using the same strategy. Look, this is over. Let's move on. We haven't. Remember, George W. Bush hasn't admitted to doing anything wrong during
ever.
His 4 years.
Ever.
Of, yeah, ever. So on that level, he did admit, you know, having a little problem with drink and, you know,
He barely admitted that.
Yeah, I know.
You know, I mean, he really didn't admit anything. You know, he doesn't. And the blame dispersal unit is in just like lockdown. They just move it around until it sort of dissipates unless somebody holds on to it.
Well, these are the hearings I think that people kind of expected really would unearth some stuff had John Kerry won the election.
Yeah.
There were people that were saying, look, we're, you know, there's going to have to be some pretty thorough investigations, particularly of Iraq. For example,
into the torture in Iraq, into the, you know, in some other things.
Waste
about,
in the Pentagon.
Yep.
You know, these kinds of things. Now, Harry Reid, the new Senate Democratic leader, and Senator Byron Dorgan, who heads the Democratic Policy Committee, are spearheading this. The first hearing will be held at the end of January. And, you know, if they just get into contract abuse in Iraq, they could spend 4 years on that single issue alone, because there's a cesspool underneath this, and we really haven't lifted the rock all the way up yet.
Yeah.
On the contract abuses that are going on. There are people, Mark Maron, I'm telling you, because we've heard about a couple of them already as fact, but there are people that are getting out, getting over like bandits over there.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing so, to some extent, on the backs of the soldiers that are over there.
Yeah, no kidding. You know, the war contracting is ridiculous. And now we also got this new, Michael Levitt was the name, the Health and Human Services.
Health and Human Services, and Human former Services. Governor of Utah.
Yeah, and, you know, the heir to a small insurance fortune. Not so small.
Not so small. His interest is supposed to be somewhere between $5 and $25 million, I guess, depending on what his stock is doing on the market. The thing is, his family business is insurance, and a small part of that business, they say only 1%, which probably means it's a little higher, but they say 1%, is in selling what's called Medigap insurance. Now, this is insurance that is specifically used to supplement Medicare payments. And guess who's going to be overseeing Medicare?
Yeah.
And the implementation of the prescription drug benefit and all the rest is this same guy.
So this is part of the neocon death cult's agenda to pander to privatizers and HMOs, insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies. This Medicare and Medicaid programs, they take up about $500 billion a year. And they keep, you know, this guy is going to come in and he wants to cut it down. He wants to cut it down like billions of dollars.
Well, here's the thing. He's coming into a situation where these kinds of programs, see, the federal government doesn't have a lot of leeway in terms of where to cut. If Bush is going to make the tax cuts permanent, if Bush is going to have to go in, some people say go into Deepak to fund the Social Security thing, something's going to have to get cut. And guess what they can cut real easily? Medicaid, Medicare. Now, that doesn't mean that individual beneficiaries get cut. What happens is those costs are passed down to the states. Cities like New York.
Yeah, but ultimately the people that get hurt the most are the people that need the Medicare and the Medicaid.
Oh, yeah. You know,
it makes it more difficult for them to get what they need. It makes it more difficult for them to use the money that's allocated to them for the stuff that they need. So basically this is a program, not unlike the Iraq War, where they're now going to sort of, you know, efficiently, you know, kill young people by keeping people in Iraq, and they're going to kill old people by making it more difficult for them to get what they need. So this is really a sort of, you know, a dark cleaning of the palate in terms of the neocon death cult agenda. This is one big movement towards death culture.
Well, watch the kind of cuts that are going to start coming out of this guy's office not long after they swear him in, assuming he's confirmed.
And apparently Medicaid, the new Medicare stuff, is already very difficult for seniors to understand that, the new drug card is really just a kickback to the pharmaceutical industries that make them, you know, able to guarantee, you know, to dictate what the prices are. And apparently when people get to call for help on this, they did some sort of poll where
they get none.
They get, you know, most of it, you know, a very high percentage of the calls are, you know, they don't receive the help they need. They're misinformed, and it's just a big chaotic mess.
Yes, and now we got a new person to preside over the mess.
Yeah, that's all it is. There's a new guy there to preside over the mess and see how he and his can make more money doing it. So
there
when
you
we
go.
Come back, let's hear a little bit of we'll check back in with an interview we did earlier in the show with Congressman Gerald Nadler about the electoral situation in Ohio, and we got Mike Birbiglia coming up, so stay tuned. It's 16 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition. It's more than just a commute companion. Listen online at morningsedition.com when you get to work, courtesy of Air America Radio.
Too fast, the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yes.
It's Morning Sedition. It's Air America Radio. It's morning time.
Yeah.
We're talking about healthcare, and I just saw this piece that Larson, Clutch Larson, forwards me this piece about this woman who had a 66-pound tumor removed from her abdomen. 66-pound tumor. And I'm sitting there going, man. And she said, she apparently knew there was something wrong.
Yeah.
You know, but apparently not enough to go check it out. I mean, at what point are you laying there and you're like, you know, maybe this will just go away? You know, what is
66 pounds.
Dude, it's horrendous.
And not only that, apparently they sent camera crews in to take pictures of it. It looks just like like the blob.
Oh, dude.
It does. I'm
dude,
sorry.
Like I couldn't, you know, it's like I saw the story and I'm like, I don't need the picture, but there's a link right there. I don't need to look at that. There's a link.
They had like 10 pictures.
They had pictures
of the woman. They had pictures of the tumor. They had pictures of the woman and the tumor together.
Well, she'd had it a long time. And you want to have your memories.
How long did she have it?
I don't know. That's horrendous. I don't know. I'm just glad she's well. I wish we could interview her only in the sense that, you know, I wonder if it had to do with health care coverage. Like the reason she didn't go was, I wonder.
Yeah.
Because, you know, for something to be festering that long and to be carrying that much weight, I don't even want to talk about it.
Yeah, you don't want to wrap your brain around that one.
Dude, I got to apologize to our listeners, because if whatever just happened to me just happened to you, just thinking about it, I have a real hard time thinking about stuff like that. I have a real hard time with illness and organs.
They're
just like, I don't know when it happened, and I cross some line where it's just like whenever I hear someone talking about kidneys or their heart or lungs, I'm just like, oh, dude, no, come on, stop it. I can't. Oh, ow.
How did you ever get through biology?
Not only biology, Mark, but my father was a surgeon
before he
stopped doing that. And I grew up literally with stacks of books and magazines, like JAMA, or was that what was it called? The Journal of American Medicine, and all these books, textbooks he had from college. I mean, literally, other kids were reading, you know, Dr. Seuss. You know, I was like, you know, looking at, you know, advanced cancers of the intestines, you know, and I'm like, and these are pictures. And I'm like, you know, I think it really screwed my head up. I remember one of them had pictures of Siamese twins in it, and that screwed my head.
I know that must have freaked you out.
Well, I mean, it gave me a lifelong fascination with the circus.
I had a friend.
I
had a friend whose father was an undertaker. That was a real...
How old are you?
Early teens.
Oh.
And we went downstairs.
Oh,
and saw
you
what
did
they
it.
Did. Yeah,
oh.
The big thing where they stayed, take all the blood out.
Oh,
you know,
dude.
Yeah, man.
Wow.
Yeah, that was deep.
Yeah.
Well, the guy grew up to be an undertaker. He took over his father's business.
Yeah, it's good business. Yeah, well,
somebody's got to do it, and we're all... mortal.
But yeah, that's absolutely true, and I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, all this stuff sort of great to me. It shouldn't, you know, on some level you should accept it, but you know, there's some things you just don't want to see.
No.
A 66-pound tumor, one of them.
Yes.
But you do want to see it, because you're like, oh my God, you should get a prize. You know, there should be a ribbon on it.
You want to be reviled. You want to be revolted.
That'd be a horrendous picture of just the tumor with a red, you know, like a big blue ribbon on it.
Sorry. What, best
this
in
is
show?
Horrible. This is horrible. Here's a Palm Pilot for today, which is brought to us by Raymond in a police officer's uniform. 8 a.m., this is Bernie Kerik's schedule. 8 a.m., wake up, check perimeter for intruders, especially hot babe intruders. Note, Fame is a chick maggot. Magnet, not maggot. Fame is not a chick maggot. 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., sit around in my undershirt. This is much better than being Homeland Security chief. 1:15 p.m. Give illegal immigrant nanny housekeeper a bonus for being the least of my problems. 1:30 p.m. Call Giuliani. Discuss co-writing article for New York Magazine called Broads. What are you going to do? 3 p.m. Call New Jersey Construction Company. Tell them to stop sending me gifts. Explain to reporters that sometimes friends in the New Jersey construction business give each other thousands of dollars in cash. 5 p.m. Call both my girlfriends and make two dates for tonight. I got the time. Hell, I'm Bernie Kerik. So let's get back to what we were going to talk about before. The Ohio Secretary of State went ahead and did the little dance. He did the satanic ritual of validating Bush's presidential
victory. Supposedly. Alleged victory.
Now, the activists and Gerald Nadler and the congressional delegation claimed that there were disparities in votes totals for the Democrats, obviously. Too few voting machines in Democrat-leaning precincts, obviously. Organized campaigns directing voters to the wrong polling place and confusion over the counting of provisional ballots by voters whose names did not appear in the records at polling places. There was also talk of, investigating the paperless machines. There were testimonies. And we talked to Nadler, you know, in reference to this. He said that there's going to be a recount. Obviously, it should have been done a few weeks ago, so we could have, you know, got the jump on this electoral vote passing. And also, you know, we asked him what could be done. If this recount shows, you know, significant disparities, they will question the election. But aside from that, here's what Jerry said we should do.
For one thing, anyone who's running the election should not be partisan in the sense of being an official of one of the election committees. Second of all, we must have, with these new electronic voting machines, we must have a paper trail so you can recount it and check it against it. Right now, the only thing you get is a statement by the machine that this was a vote. If you recount, yes or no statement, you get the same thing. There is no assurance whatsoever. Thirdly, we ought to have standards that for every X number of voters, you must have a machine so that you don't have a discrepancy. I think Congress ought to pass a statute for national voting standards for federal elections. They're not constitutional power to do so, and we ought to do so, and take some of this discretion away from state officials.
That was Congressman Gerald Nadler on our show about an hour ago.
Yeah.
We got Mike Birbiglia. Mike Birbiglia is going to join us in the studio. His latest CD is called Dog Ears. He's a comedian. Very funny guy. He's going to be at Caroline's tonight.
Yeah, headlining.
Yeah, and we got, you know, the other stuff we do here. So stay with us. It's 28 past the hour, Air America Radio. Before past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Oh, wait, we got to, let me take this call. We got Ted in Nebraska. Ted, what's going on, buddy?
Good morning, Mark and Mark.
Hey.
Once again, the liberal spin machine going full bore today. You guys can't seem to do anything without discussing the agenda put together.
Oh, no, I hate when it... help me, Riley. Oh, my God. Oh, no, it's happening. My thoughts are starting to change. I'm becoming him. Oh, no.
Now, Pennsylvania.
And now, live from Radio Halliburton, it's Right and Early, the conservatives' way to wake up. With Mark, the Shark, Maron.
Good morning, Neocon. It's 20 after the hour here on Radio Halliburton. Halliburton, pay us what we're worth, then add a few zeros. That's right, Christmas is coming. Oh my, I'm gonna... Oh, there's some eggnog for you, liberals. Hey, W's going after Social Security. What's the matter, socialists? Afraid you're gonna lose your government handout? Oh, I'm so old and I can't work anymore, and I want the government to pay for all my food and rent and doctor's bills. Whoa, welfare granny, the bathroom's down the hall. There she goes. Oh, take off running, you old lazy deadbeats. Mark the Shark is hunting for Great Panther. And here he goes. It's no fun killing old people. They're way too slow. They even bleed slow.
Game over, man.
Hey,
game
over. That's right, game over. W wants to put the Ten Commandments in public buildings. Mandate, 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 mandate. What's the matter, liberals? Scared of the truth? Here's one of my own. Thou shalt not. 22 after the hour. Let's take a call. You're on the air, caller.
Limousine liberals, gun control treat.
Yeah, you couldn't be more right, caller. Liberal Holly weirdos like Julia Roberts shouldn't be allowed to have twins. Oh, come here, kid. Oh, there's one down. Oh, that's two. Problem solved. Take that, Aaron Brockovich. Hey, it's 24 after the hour, time for the Neocon Power Weather Forecast. Look for it to be unseasonably cold with a chilly mixture of church and state. Look for the courts to be hard-packed, so get out your skis. Oh, I'm sorry. Hey, get out of your Carrick, you lying traitor. Yes, so stick around, Neocons. We'll be back with Toby Keith.
Don't touch that dial, Patriot. We'll be back with Right and Early.
What, Lee, man? What?
Are you okay, man?
What are you all right? I don't know what the hell. Did I black out or something? Well, anyways, I don't know. Right now, a friend of mine, a guy I know who I've seen since he was just a young, just a sprout comic.
A sprout comic.
Yes, his latest CD is called Dog Ears, and it's available through our website, and I imagine through his. We'll ask him in a minute. He's headlining tonight at Caroline's here in New York City. He'll be there January 4th and 5th. Oh, yeah, www.birbigs.com. That's BIRBIGS.com. Mike Birbiglia is here. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, man. How are you doing?
I'm great.
Yeah?
I just got back from Dayton, Ohio.
You're in Dayton, Ohio? I've never been to Dayton, Ohio. Is there a club there?
Joker's Comedy Club.
How was it?
Joker's Comedy Cafe.
Yeah, you're becoming the young road man.
I'm a road hack.
Yeah, so
a huge road hack. First of all, I want to call something out. I was very excited to come here because I'm a big fan of the show and the network, and then I went in to get coffee. And on the television in the coffee room, the nanny is playing in syndication.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. Fran Drescher,
yeah.
Too?
Yeah. No. Yeah, I'm like, oh, I'm here at the smart radio network, and then
the
nanny, and then two people watching it.
Yeah, well, you know, that's what you do here. You know, that's what radio is all about.
Yeah,
you just go outside and watch crappy TV. If you
hey, wait till later. I'm going to be watching Jerry Springer.
Springer,
yeah, yeah.
Love personal it. Springer act. So tell us about the
over at Limbaugh, they're watching Just Shoot Me. It's like one step up.
Yeah. So what was tell me about Ohio. I was in Columbus. I used to like playing in Columbus.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
a great room there.
Yeah, yeah. That's
that
nice.
Guy's a good guy.
It's interesting being out there in the red states. It's, you know, people in New York. A lot of people in New York just go, what's it like? But it's weird because I never did any political stuff. It was funny because a while back you had sort of said, we're the only people who can say any comics. Or the only people who can say anything real, you know. And I always said, Mark's crazy. but then at a certain point, I realized I was in Pittsburgh shortly before the election.
Uh-huh.
And this guy was opening up the show and he was doing all this pro-Bush stuff.
Yeah.
And it bubbled me over. I didn't have any political stuff.
So this is
stuff.
Your middle guy?
Yeah.
The guy is he's gone before you.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And it set the tone for the show, and I was so angry.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And so I wrote anti-Bush stuff that week to counterbalance the show.
And how did it go over?
It was terrible. It went terribly. And I tried to make it even-handed. I said, you know, I understand people like Bush. I understand he's the kind of guy you invite to the barbecue because he's going to start the wiffle ball game.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
He's like wiffle ball Tony.
But they tried to humanize Antichrist.
Right, and I say, but then one day somebody's like, we're going to put Tony in charge of everything.
Yeah,
and I'm like, we are the burgers and the potato salad.
Yeah, that's
going to be a problem because you're competitive.
Yeah.
Starts going to the neighbor's lawn, challenging them to wiffle ball game, saying, "What's up? You want to play wiffle ball?" And they're like, "We don't want to play." He's like, starts chucking hamburgers at them. We're like, "Tony, what are you doing, man?" He's like, "They were going to chuck hamburgers at me," but then it turns out they don't even have hamburgers. Turns out they're vegetarian.
How'd that go, dude?
Terribly.
Really?
Well,
did you make it work eventually?
You know, it was one of the first times where I think that you kind of revel in this.
Yeah.
The first time where the audience was booing and cheering at the same time.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
Well, I revel in that because that's what I grew up with. That's my parents. One was booing, one was cheering all the time. It's very confusing, but invigorating.
It feels
like love to me.
I was in Washington, D.C. a few weeks before the election.
Yeah.
And people get very tense about it. A woman came up to me and she's like, you know, he could be here.
Okay. Oh, really?
And I go, first of all, no.
Yeah.
Second of all, he wouldn't understand the analogy.
He'd
be like, hamburgers. I go for a hamburger.
Yeah. You know, that's weird that when people say that, things like that, like he could be here. It's like, maybe the president will just slip in under the radar.
Yeah, yeah.
We're not going to know that he's here. So, like, you've been doing this, you know, for a few years.
Yeah, sure.
Like, I remember, you know, when you started out and when I didn't like you.
I remember that.
But you also do theater, right?
Yeah.
What's that play you did about?
I just did a play last year, wrote a one-act play called Baby on a Train. And
yeah.
It's just a sort of a dark romantic comedy.
Isn't that weird about comics is that, like, you know, deep down, you know, we're these weird brooding, you know, freaks who want to be validated on a different level and seek higher aesthetic ideas, and then we go out and... So is that sort of like the secret life? It's like, yeah, that's got nothing to do with my CD or my comedy career. That's something I do in this weird dark theater across town.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah, I have this, you know, secret fantasy. It's all going to come together.
It's all going to meet around top, and that way you won't have any audience at all.
Right.
Yeah, but you've probably built yourself a pretty good audience and going out on the road a lot.
People start to show up a little bit.
Do people recognize you from television and whatnot?
No one watches television.
Come on! You did one of those half hours, didn't you?
Yeah.
Did that do anything?
No, it does. You know, some people start to show up on purpose, which is good.
Yeah, show up on purpose. As opposed to just sort of like, how do I get to this comedy
show? That's what it is. I mean, to kind of, can we not say that?
Yeah.
That's the type of drink at a bar. that's what it is.
Well, yeah, or what's worse yet is when nothing creeps in more at a comedy club than when the bachelorette parties show up with the bride's hat on. If I see like a veil, I'm like, oh no, this is going to require babysitting.
Yeah.
We're going to have to give attention to this person.
Yeah.
Why do they come to comedy clubs? I don't even understand that.
It's because they get free tickets.
Is that it?
They pay for these rooms.
So when you travel, what's the best place that you find? Who are the best audiences?
No, Cincinnati's fine.
Cincinnati?
Yeah.
The whole world?
No, I'm just trying to think, like, where I've been recently. San Francisco's great, obviously, you know.
That's weird. You wouldn't think, like, Cincinnati's good.
It's all right, yeah.
Audiences happen in weird places, good audiences.
Yeah, it's all right. But, you know, Dayton's tough. I did a show this week where I was talking about something, and it had to do with homosexuality, and it was really quiet in the room.
Uh-huh.
And then I go, can I just stop the show for a second? Just by random applause, how many people voted for Bush?
Uh-huh.
And everyone applauded, and then I go, did anyone vote for Kerry? And this one guy applauded, and he goes, I ain't proud of it.
And the rest of the crowd beat the hell out of
him. Yeah. It was very strange.
We'll be back with Mike Birbiglia, 44 past the hour, Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition. It's not Marxism. It's Marxism. Mark Maron and Mark Riley every morning on Air America Radio.
Like a microphone theme. Like a microphone theme. Like a microphone theme. Like a microphone theme.
Yeah. 49 past the hour. That's Riley not knowing.
Evening at the Improv.
Mark Riley doing a mic test. I had no idea that Dan Passion, son of Lewis and Linda Passion, Brendan P.W. McDonald set it to music.
Yeah, no good deed goes unpunished either. Still got 3 days before I leave town.
It's 50 past the hour at Air America Radio. We're talking to Mike Birbiglia. His latest CD is called Dog Years. It's available through our website or at www.birbigs.com. He's a comedian, if you haven't been listening. I imagine your tour dates are on there, too.
Yeah, sure.
So you live in New York. Did you take a cab down here today or what, in the middle of the night?
Yeah, in the middle of the night, yeah.
All the cabbies are listening to our stations. You know that? Was he listening to our station? Tell me the truth.
No, sorry.
All right, thanks.
No.
Yeah.
But I had a funny story the other day. I found someone's wallet.
Mm-hmm.
My girlfriend and I were in a cab.
Oh, yeah.
Someone's wallet.
Yeah.
And we tried to track down the woman.
Right.
We made it like a, you know, like a Blue's Clues kind of hunt.
You didn't immediately spend the money?
It had hundreds. It had like $240.
You're a good guy. I would do the same thing.
Well, I just did it for the story.
No. So you actually had the moment like, we could go out and eat, or I could get a bit out of this.
Yeah. Well, okay. No, so we tried to track it. We called her AAA. We called her, you know, all these places. Ended up getting in touch with her. We sent the wallet back with the cash in it. But this is so great. It's like, I was like, who cares? You know, it's a nice thing to do.
Yeah.
I got a typewritten letter yesterday from them saying, Dear Mr. Birbiglia, miracles do happen.
Oh.
Who can believe, certainly none of our friends, that a lost wallet with numerous credit cards and $200 in cash would be graciously returned to it by its finder, even to the extent of initiating a search for the wallet owner? And it's just like, my wife and I are very grateful.
Where are they from?
California.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, a lot of the reason I did it was I'm so sick of just, like, people, the cliche about New York. It's like, New York's tough.
Yeah, everybody's tough. Yeah.
Like, people are really nice here.
No, I've said that on the air before. Me and Riley did a big riff about that the other day. I think they're the nicest people in the world. They go out of their way to help each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing that people can't get through their heads, aside from that myth that was sort of, I think, put forth in the 70s, that this was sort of a more dangerous place. But
people
are tolerant. They are tough. But, you know, there's this idea that we're all angry. We're not angry. Yeah. We're just trying to get, let's just keep it moving. You know, we got things to do. There are people right here.
Absolutely. And speaking of which is, like, I find there's no racism here compared to the rest of the country. You know, I don't know how you deal with it.
Riley, would you like to address the racism in New York City? I have found that for me, you know, that I think it is the most well-integrated city that I've ever lived in, personally.
It is. Actually, Queens is the most integrated borough in America.
Mm-hmm.
Statistically speaking. Yeah. New York is...
And that's why I live there, by the way, because I like to be at the cutting edge of integration in this world.
Yeah, he goes to the Yemeni shopkeeper, Brazilian...
I stay away from the Ukrainian bar around the corner. That creates a little bit.
I find, you know, I think the reason there's racism is there's suburbs. Because in the suburbs, a lot of times, there's only one black guy in the whole town. Uh-huh. What if that guy's a jerk?
Hey, wait a minute. That black guy was once me. Okay?
Yeah.
I grew
yeah.
up in the town. I was one of two black families in the town.
Yeah.
This is in Connecticut.
Yeah.
Yeah. You get a very different view of life when you're raised around white people. I just want you to know.
Like what, that must have been pretty profound. I mean, like, was there always, like, sort of this walking on eggshell thing?
Well, there were times when I was in school when people used to make generalizations about black people in the class while I was sitting there.
Yeah.
And the teacher would always kind of, like, hitch his step, you know, kind of, well, wait a minute now, you're a Negro, can you tolerate heat better than we can? I was asked that when I was in, like, the sixth grade.
Oh, like, class, we do have a Negro in the room.
In the room, yes,
that's what happens, though, because I grew up in a town, there's one black guy, all my assumptions are based on that one person.
That one person.
Like, they love Skittles.
Yeah.
Oh, and no. Their name is Ted.
Yeah.
All of them are named Ted.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is, there was always this, well, you know, you're our black guy,
mm-hmm.
kind of thing. You know, the rest of those Negroes that are out marching for civil rights, that's one thing. But you, Mark, you're one of us.
Oh, yeah. So they're actually talking to other high schools. It's like, do you guys got a black guy?
Yeah, yeah. You got a brother over there? Most of the other towns had more black people than the town. I never knew why my mom decided to move to that particular town. But there were always other towns around us that had substantial numbers of black people. I just didn't associate with any of them.
Yeah,
my mother wouldn't let me.
It was weird. I grew up with one of my best friends growing up is this kid, Dave, who his father was black. His mother was Jewish. And she was a lesbian who lived with her girlfriend. And his father lived down in this, like, this weird part of town where he lived in a trailer and fixed old cars. It was just like, he was like, you know, it was this gateway to this whole mystical world down in this weird sort of hippie part of town. I had a couple of friends that were from there. And he was like, Dave was great. He had this great big, he had the huge fro and he had the little pick with the fist on it. You know, the Afro pick that...
All black people at one time or another. All black men had the pick with the fist on it. Yeah. I mean, that was what we did. And see, you could walk around and it would actually stay in the back of your Afro.
With that fist sticking out of the
air. Yeah, so you didn't ruin your pants.
I wonder what happened to that guy. I think he was driving an ambulance for a while. He's a good cat. Where do you live now, Mike?
I live downtown. Next to the Comedy Cellar.
Oh, yeah, down by there.
Yeah. I've got my good building. We have our own drug dealer.
No, right there
and,
in the building. That's great.
A guy. Literally, every time I walk out my door, guy's like, yo, man, you want weed? You want rock? You know, walking out, I get Snapple.
Yeah.
I'm like, you have any Snapple?
I'm like, Snapple, please.
I think he should also sell Snapple. That way he hooks you in with the Snapple. And he's like, you know what will go great with that Snapple? Crack. You know, like, it'd be like Amazon.com. If you like Snapple, you'll also like...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Special K.
The package.
Yeah.
I used to, when I lived on the Lower East Side, when I lived in Boston, I lived right next in a very weird sort of crack whore section. Like, there were all, the worst kind of prostitutes, and I'd have to go outside to repark my car at like 7:30 in the morning, and these women would be up all night, and they'd just be, you know, just wasted and ragged and awful. And I remember going out, you know, sort of half awake to park my car, and one woman walks right up to me, grabs my crotch, and says, you want a date? And I'm like, yeah, okay, how about breakfast? You want to have breakfast? And park my car with me? Awful. Just
but I have this place. It's like, you know, it's like the size of the studio.
That's big.
This is what it. Yeah,
this
it's
is
a little
big.
Smaller. Than this. A little smaller.
Is it like a studio?
Yeah, studio.
Yeah.
It's a little smaller than this.
Yeah,
but I moved into this place, and I have this habit of making awkward situations even more awkward. Mm-hmm. I was moving my bed in, and this woman who lived in the building opened the front door for me with her key, and she goes, "I'm not worried because a rapist wouldn't have a bed like that." Now, what I should have said was nothing.
Yeah.
What I did say was, you'd be surprised.
Good thing to say. That's Mike Birbiglia. He is at Caroline's tonight. It's and also on January 4th and 5th. That's in New York. You can go to his website, www.birbigs.com, B-I-R-B-I-G-S. If you want to know where he's playing, if you want to get a CD, you can also get it at our website at morningsedition.com. Thanks for coming, Mike.
I'm going to go watch The Nanny. Thanks for having me on.
Hang out for a minute. There's our liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. These are your marching orders for today. Write them down. One. Strike the words, God bless us, everyone, from A Christmas Carol. We can't budge an inch on this stuff, people. Two, send our soldiers thesauruses to arm them for the upcoming war of words. 3. As a special Christmas treat for your 8-year-olds, make sugar cookies and show them the movie Kinsey. They gotta learn. 4. Stage nude militant lesbian version of the Nutcracker.
Ooh.
Hey, come on. 5. Today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. You know who poisoned Yushchenko, don't you? It was Bush, man. Wake up. That family will stop at nothing. Nothing, people. Come on. Let's get on the same page here.
So,
what?
Mary.
What?
Tomorrow.
All right.
Philip Milano.
Oh, yeah.
Author of I Can't Believe You Asked That.
Oh, yeah. Listeners, think of some questions.
Think of
really
some questions.
Weird
no
ones.
Matter how weird, no matter how uncomfortable.
Or wrong.
Race, religion, gender, sexual orientation. He's got all the answers tomorrow here on Air America Radio. Have a good one, Mary.
You too, Riley.